That's very interesting to hear, but what about all these philosophical differences that I've been hearing about? He laughed, a real nice and sincere one, and he says to me that there really are philosophical differences, but he realized that between the two, he preferred Nintendo's philosophy. Everyone chuckled, refilled their drinks, picked at the food, and continued to decline Arakawa's invitations to go swimming. This joyous cycle continued for hours, until the sun began to set, and guests took this as their cue to go home. But even as the celebration thinned out, many of Nintendo's longer-tenured employees still remained. Maine, Lincoln, White, Harmon, and pretty much anyone who could positively identify Rob the Robot. These were the people who, no matter what, would forever be bonded by an incredible experience. They hadn't chosen each other, but they had all chosen Nintendo. And that meant that despite their differing personalities, they all shared a unified philosophy. For better or worse, they were part of the same family. And thank God these past few months had been veering toward the better. By the time it happened, nobody remembered whose idea it was, but the men of Nintendo found themselves swimming in the pool. Because of the drinks, the laughter, and the intrinsic nature of barbecues, the last few hours had become a blur. But like the moonlight shimmying through the water, it was a nice blur to be a part of. They weren't quite sure what tomorrow would bring, but they were confident that everything would work out okay as long as they continued to do things the Nintendo way. It wasn't always flashy, and it wasn't always popular. But it was a slow journey into what was possible, and they couldn't wait for Arakawa to lead them there. Chapter 34 Cops and Robbers. Toward the end of the summer, Tom Kalinske could feel Sega's momentum slipping. Although Anik's passing had instinctively triggered a desire to take his foot off the pedal and spend more time with his family, that just seemed selfish at a time when Nintendo was beginning to wake up. He owed so much to Sega, to its people and their sacrifices, that postponing personal goals for professional ones was the least he could do. It was not ideal, but he was willing to do what was best for the company. In the long run, Sega's revolution would make the world a better place for him, his family, and kids everywhere. Is that how you really feel, or is that just a convenient justification? The question hung out there for a bloated second, as Kalinske realized that the words that had just come out of his mouth applied as much to himself as they did to the man on the other end of the phone. He shook off the strangely surreal moment, and in the solitude of his home office, he repeated the question. Do you honestly feel that way? Or are you just rationalizing decisions made in the past? That's a good question, Nintendo's Bill White said from his home in Redmond, Washington. But I'm afraid it might be a rhetorical one. What does it matter if I'm happy at Nintendo? I'm here, it's a great company, and the people are generally acceptable. Oh, yeah, and one more thing that I probably should have started with. It's none of your goddamn business. Although White had said this last part harshly, both men couldn't help but laugh, because it was the first thing that either one had uttered during the call that even began to resemble sincerity. Okay, White continued. Now I've got one for you. How did you get my number? And no, it's not a rhetorical question. Don't worry about the how, Kalinske suggested. I'd like to talk about the why. And if it's not immediately obvious from my calling you at home and asking about your current employment situation, it's because I'd like you to come join us at Sega. Ever since Sega had failed to hire Howard Phillips, Kalinske had been looking to poach someone else from the royal family. But because Nintendo was such a small outfit, and because their employees rarely ever left the company, this was no easy mission. Bill White, however, seemed like the best candidate, and recent rumblings that he was growing increasingly frustrated by Nintendo's neutered marketing approach made Kalinske cautiously optimistic. Plus, there was the fortuitous connection of Bill's sister, Renee. She was the general manager at Sega's old ad agency, Bozell. She had actually been the one to introduce the two of them, and by virtue of that relationship, Kalinske imagined that Bill differed from his Nintendo colleagues and actually had some shred of respect for Sega. Or, at least, he didn't think they were Satan incarnate. Either way, it was worth a call, especially during a period when Nintendo was gaining steam and Sega was waiting on Sonic Tuesday, the first round of Goodby commercials, and a handful of next-level business opportunities. Although White had little interest in leaving Nintendo, his ego was instinctively boosted by Kalinske's offer. It felt like a notorious robber asking a decorated cop to join his crew for a big heist. Sure, the offer was insultingly presumptuous, but there was also something inherently flattering about it. A suggestion that, in this world of black and white, there was something uniquely gray about your character that signified a flourish on both sides of the law. "I appreciate the consideration," White said, "but I don't have any interest in making a move at this time." The last three words, "at this time," convinced Kalinske not to end the call. Over the past few years, White had been programmed to fundamentally despise Sega. But there was something about those three words that indicated that perhaps he could be reprogrammed. And so, at this time, Kalinske decided to keep pushing. "Come on, Bill," Kalinske pleaded. "I can't sit here and genuinely believe that you're happy with things at Nintendo. From everything I've heard and the few times we've met, I can tell that you're not some drink-the-Kool-Aid ad man, but someone who actually appreciates the art of marketing. And I don't know if you get that from your father or your sister, or if it was just something you were born with, but you've got the gift. And I'm confident that Nintendo isn't utilizing it properly."
"Nice of you to say," White said. "But I'm curious how you arrived at that conclusion. It's certainly not from my sister. She and I never talk business."
"No, that's not from Renee," Kalinske said. "I would never even consider exploiting a family relationship like that. My assumption comes from a much more obvious source, Nintendo's advertisements."
"What about them?"
"They're terrible."
"Screw you."
"Okay," Kalinske corrected. "They're not terrible. They're good. Never great, never groundbreaking, never even memorable. They're always just good enough. And I understand why Nintendo would want to do things that way, but I also understand why, if I were in your position, I'd want to rip my hair out."
"Interesting assumption," White mused. "Although I am quite sure that the last time we saw each other, I was not missing a single hair on my head."
"I didn't notice one way or another," Kalinske said. "I was probably too busy thinking about that $65 million generation-defining campaign that we're gearing up to launch."
"That much?" White asked. "I thought it was only $45 million.
"Don't believe everything you read in the press," Kalinske said. "Besides, does it really matter whether it's $65 million, $45 million, or even just $5 million? It's money that will be spent on actual marketing, messaging, branding, influencing culture. People are going to be talking about this so much that I bet the water cooler business doubles."
"Huh," White replied. "And the unfounded self-aggrandizing business might triple, right?"
"Look, you're obviously someone who..." "What about the movie?" Kalinske cut in.
"What is that supposed to mean?"
"I know a few journalists, and they seem pretty convinced that what's happening in North Carolina is a complete disaster."
"That's a lie," White said, knowing full well that what Kalinske had said was, in fact, the truth.
Or at least it had been when Los Angeles Times writer Richard Staton visited the North Carolina film set earlier that summer. The movie in question was Super Mario Brothers, the same one that Peter Mayne had excitedly announced at the Consumer Electronics Show back in January 1991.
"Hey, Tom, why don't you do yourself a favor and heed your own advice? Don't believe everything you hear from the press, especially the lies."
Like every movie ever made, Super Mario Brothers started off with the best of intentions. In early 1990, just weeks after The Wizard hit the box office, White decided to get serious about making a movie based on Nintendo's incredibly popular plumber. With The Wizard, which starred Fred Savage and centered around an autistic video game prodigy, Nintendo had agreed to license their logos, trademarks, and game footage to Universal Pictures, who produced and distributed the movie. Nintendo was paid $100,000 for the intellectual property, but notably, and contrary to public opinion, they had no creative approval over the final film beyond the initial script and the implementation of game footage. On one hand, this deal could be viewed as a major coup for Nintendo, who was actually being paid to have a 90-minute commercial produced about its games. But on the other hand, in this case the dominant hand, a company who considered their best quality to be control, had effectively parted with that right for a modest sum. This is not to say that Universal kept Nintendo in the dark, because they didn't. White even had an open invitation to visit the set in Reno,
but it cautioned Nintendo against getting involved in a similar situation, especially after the resulting film turned out to be exceptionally mediocre, fun and watchable, but not much more than a 90-minute Nintendo commercial. Perhaps Nintendo's commercials were guilty of being just good enough, but everything else the company produced was great. So when White pushed the idea of a Mario movie, Arakawa had been open to the idea as long as the movie could achieve greatness. Throughout 1990, several movie studios made pitches to Nintendo with story ideas, production budgets, and potential talent for the feature film. Competition for the film rights was intense, particularly at a time when four of the year's highest-grossing films turned out to be action-adventure family movies. Home Alone, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Dick Tracy, and Kindergarten Cop. The suitors each made multi-million dollar offers, but as Nintendo had learned with The Wizard, the money came with strings attached. At this time, Nintendo cared less about the money and more about controlling those strings, which led them to bypass the movie studios in favor of a pair of independent filmmakers, Jake Eberts and Roland Joffe. When Eberts and Joffe presented their creative vision, they were less concerned with their production company's stature and more concerned about their personal track record. Both had made great films, but those films tended to involve death, rape, and the fragility of human life. Like The Killing Fields, a 1984 Joffe-directed film about Cambodian dictator Pol Pot state-sponsored genocide of 2 million innocent civilians. Although this was several shades darker than King Koopa's Death by Goomba strategy, Arakawa was impressed with the adult-skewed pitch, and thought that perhaps a more serious film could attract an even larger audience. Feeling like Eberts and Joffe offered the best chance of something more than mediocrity, Arakawa and Yamauchi sold them the film rights to Super Mario Brothers at a reduced rate in October 1990. And from there, everything that could go wrong did. Murphy's Law first reared its head when Bill White, Nintendo's point guy for the film, received a call from Joffe letting him know that Dustin Hoffman was extremely interested in playing the role of Mario. White was thrilled by this news, believing that the Oscar-winning actor had the perfect skill set to achieve Nintendo's lofty goals. The dramatic chops to skew older, Rain Man, the cartoonish eccentricities to skew younger, Hook, and the ability to be taken seriously while acting silly, Tootsie. White asked Joffe to set up a meeting, and then excitedly brought this news to Arakawa, who didn't share the same enthusiasm. Instead, he just kind of scratched his head and said that Hoffman wouldn't be right for the part. In traditional Arakawa fashion, when he was asked if there was any particular reason why not, NOA's president thought for a moment, squinted ever so slightly, and then quietly said no before moving on to the next thing. By the time this response was relayed back to Joffe, a meeting had already been set up with the actor. As a result, White was sent to New York for a 2-hour meeting with Hoffman, where he was forced to reluctantly rain on Rain Man's parade. With Hoffman out of the picture, White and the producers set their sights on Danny DeVito, who resembled a pudgy, charismatic plumber as much as anyone in Hollywood. Arakawa approved of this new choice, but the feeling turned out not to be mutual when DeVito turned down the role in order to focus on his directing career. Next on the list was a young actor named Tom Hanks, who agreed to take the role for $5 million. But before signing the deal, the producers and Nintendo started to have second thoughts. Hanks' recent credits included The Burbs, Turner and Hooch, and Joe vs. the Volcano, spurring serious doubts that he could handle a dramatic role. There were also concerns that although Hanks was tremendously likable, he lacked that it factor to carry a big-budget movie. And with Super Mario Brothers, now budgeted at a hefty $40 million, the offer to Hanks was pulled. Hanks wasn't thrilled, but quickly got over the loss when his next two films, A League of Their Own and Sleepless in Seattle, made him the most popular actor in Hollywood, and the next two, Philadelphia and Forrest Gump, won him Academy Awards for Best Actor. When attaching actors to a film, this game of musical chairs is pretty common. But when it happens with writers and directors, that usually signifies it's time to put your tray table in the upright position and brace for a crash landing in development hell. Although Joffe had directed many movies, he saw Super Mario Brothers as the perfect vehicle to launch his producing career. Wanting to focus only on that aspect, he hired Greg Beeman to direct the movie. Beeman had a powerful, whimsical style, but because he had directed only one film to date, and because that film was an 8 million teen adventure romp starring Corey Feldman and Corey Haim, no distributor would finance production with Beeman at the helm. Without financing, there'd be no movie. So Beeman was jettisoned in favor of Rocky Morton and Annabelle Jankel, a husband and wife directing team based in London. Morton and Jankel were a pair of former music video directors famous for creating the Max Headroom Show, a cutting-edge British TV program featuring the world's first computer-generated talk show host. In keeping with Max Headroom's subversive spirit, Morton and Jankel wanted the movie not only to skew older, but also to slant much darker, dingier, and a bit demented. Although this direction frightened White and Nintendo more than a little, they had approved the hiring of Morton and Jankel, so it stood to reason that they ought to let their new directors do what they did best. In order to pull that off, however, the new directors needed a script that reflected their hyperkinetic vision. The original script for Super Mario Bros. Was supposed to be written by Barry Morrow, who had recently won an Academy Award for his Rain Man screenplay, but his initial treatment outlined a darker movie than Nintendo had anticipated. Like Rain Man, Morrow's vision centered around the complexity of brotherly relationships, and even mimicked the relationship between Tom Cruise's and Dustin Hoffman's characters, with Mario serving as something of a heroic guardian to his lower-functioning younger brother Luigi. Nintendo wanted serious, but this was too serious. And besides, wasn't The Wizard already kind of a Nintendo-inspired reboot of Rain Man? Instead of revising his vision, Morrow was displeased by its reception, not to mention Dustin Hoffman's being passed over for Mario, and stepped aside to allow someone else to give it a go. As a result, while the press kept printing stories about how an Oscar winner was bringing Mario to the big screen, the first script was actually penned by Jim Gentlewine and Tom S. Parker in early 1991. Gentlewine and Parker were an unusual choice, given that they had no previous screenwriting credits. But although they lacked experience, they possessed something that Hollywood valued even more. Heat. A few months earlier, the unknown pair had sold a spec script called Stay Tuned to Morgan Creek for $750,000. And in the period that followed, they became the industry's newest next great writers and got the gig to write Super Mario Brothers. Gentlewine and Parker, who went on to script child-friendly adaptations of The Flintstones and Richie Rich, wrote a lighthearted modern-day fairy tale that upped the ante for an adult audience with complex characters and tongue-in-cheek humor. The script was praised by Nintendo and the producers, but because it had been written specifically for Beeman to direct it, it was tossed aside when Morton and Jankel took over. The new directors wanted something less fantastical and more steeped in the mythos of science fiction. To give life to this concept, they hired Parker Bennett and Terry Runty, who were best known for writing the outlandish movie Mystery Date, about a teenage boy whose dream date with the girl next door turns into a nightmare when he finds a dead body in the trunk, and other horrors ensue. Again, White and Nintendo were skeptical of where this was headed, but they felt that Morton and Jankel deserved the chance to follow their instincts. Besides, they had the safety of creative approval. To Nintendo's surprise, the sci-fi script was actually not so bad. It had the futuristic flair of a space opera, but still contained many enjoyable fantasy tropes, like Mario and Luigi being at the center of an age-old prophecy, and a magical talking book that aids the plumbers on their quest through a mushroom-infested reality. By mid-1991, the project now seemed to be moving in a direction that satisfied Nintendo, the producers, and the directors. Despite a few false starts to the process, the many parties involved with the movie couldn't help but breathe a sigh of relief and give in to the notion that this just might work out after all. But little did they know that all this was soon to be sabotaged by the directors. Morton and Jankel eventually deemed this latest script to be too blah and had the writers amp it up to be more like Ghostbusters, larger than life, comedic, and centered around a snarky Bill Murray type. With this in mind, Bennett and Runty introduced the concept of Dino-Hattan, a parallel urban universe where dinosaurs had never gone extinct and where King Koopa and his evil cronies ruled with an iron fist. As the writers were rushing to finish the draft, Bob Hoskins, and not a Bill Murray-esque actor like Tom Hanks, was now the top target to play Mario, and major revisions were needed. With the financiers pressing the filmmakers to get this movie into production, The directors fired the writers and replaced them with Dick Clement and Ian LaFrenée, who delivered something more in the action-packed vein of Die Hard, and whose script even included a scene where Bruce Willis made a cameo, tunneling through the air ducts of King Koopa's castle. Nintendo and the producers saw the script and wanted something more grounded, which led Clement and LaFrenée to write another draft that had the realism that Nintendo wanted, the grit that the producers desired, and the off-kilter dystopian feel that the directors craved. By appeasing all parties, this March 1992 draft was sent out to potential actors and proved sturdy enough to entice Bob Hoskins, Mario, John Leguizamo, Luigi, and Dennis Hopper, King Koopa, to sign on to the movie. Production was slated for 2 months later in North Carolina, and things appeared to be back on track. But producers Jake Ebert and Roland Joffe began to worry that the script's current iteration was too far removed from the video game sensibilities and needed to be made lighter and more fun. Nintendo agreed that the tone was more mature, but with Sega beginning to attract older gamers, maybe more mature was a good thing. Ebert and Joffe understood where Nintendo was coming from, and they themselves did not want to make a syrupy children's movie, but they wanted something that was more accessible and less bizarre. This bizarre tone, of course, was the handiwork of Morton and Jankel, who had been hired to bring this exact sensibility. By this point, however, the producers realized that they had made a huge mistake with their choice of director, and with Nintendo's permission, they hoped to salvage any chance at a blockbuster by bringing in some script doctors. Nintendo consented, leading Ebert and Joffe to hire Ed Solomon, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and Ryan Rowe, Tapeheads, to punch things up before filming began in May. Because Ebert and Joffe believed that Morton and Jankel were the ones responsible for all of the problems, the producers forbade the directors from even speaking with the writers, which created a rift that lasted throughout production. When the actors arrived on the set and received shooting scripts, they were shocked by how much the story had been changed, and they considered quitting the film. The producers then tried to rehire Dick Clement and Ian LaFrenée to undoctor their already doctored script, but they weren't available for the job. Instead, Parker Bennett and Terry Runty, who had written the draft that Clement and LaFrenée had once upon a time redrafted, were hired and flown down to North Carolina. Upon arrival, Bennett and Runty worked closely with the producers, directors, and cast members to make script changes on the fly and play the unenviable role of creative peacemakers. Their already difficult job was made even more frustrating by the fact that the actors weren't talking to the directors weren't talking to the producers, and nobody was talking to Nintendo. Over the next several weeks, things went from hell to the Inferno Seventh Circle. The directors lost any remaining allies when Morton poured hot coffee on an extra he didn't think looked dirty enough. But amazingly, this obscene incident was soon trumped by another. Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo disliked working on the film so much that they began drinking on the set, which may or may not have been the reason behind Leguizamo crashing a car and injuring his fictional brother during production, which resulted in Hoskins having to wear a cast that can be seen in various scenes throughout the film. With all the chaos, the production schedule ballooned from 10 weeks to 15, forcing the producers to scrap the original climactic finale that would have featured Mario scaling the Brooklyn Bridge and saving the day by dropping an explosive bob-omb down King Koopa's throat. Instead, they opted for the much cheaper alternative of Mario simply shooting King Koopa with a gun. The entire production was an unmitigated disaster. Bill White knew that. He had seen it firsthand. But still, a part of him couldn't help but wonder if things might turn out okay after all. Drama and insubordination aside, they'd at least shot enough footage to piece together a coherent 90-minute film. And however bad it turned out to be, nothing could take away the fact that the movie would have stars, special effects, and the iconic Mario name. By this point, White was willing to admit that it would not be nominated for any Academy Awards, but there was still a good chance that it would make a ton of money. Take the game Super Mario Bros. 2, for instance, which was Nintendo of America's last-minute attempt to put a Band-Aid on Japan's sequel. That game was weird and kind of creepy, but still managed to sell 10 million copies. So, despite whatever it was that Kalinske thought he knew about the movie, White knew the truth. And he also knew the greater truths about hype-driven consumer culture. "I don't know what you've heard," White said to Kalinske, "but I'm more than happy to bet you that it will wind up being the highest-grossing film of the year." "Well then," Kalinske replied. I guess I need to get myself some better sources. I just figured that if the movie turned out to be as bad as a few folks have been saying, Nintendo is going to be looking for a fall guy.
And you think I'll be the fall guy?
What happened to speaking in theoreticals?
Good point, White said. I don't think we should be speaking at all. I appreciate the call, and honestly, I'm flattered by your insults, but it's time for me to go.
Wait, Kalinske said with a dash of urgency. I have just one more question.
Ask fast, White said, before I hang up.
Fine, fine, Kalinske said. I was just wondering if you might be able to tell me.
What the hell is this Mode 7 thing?
Chapter 35 Shoshinkai. Tony Harmon stared out the window of a Tokaido Shinkansen bullet train, admiring the extraordinary way Japan's green-gray-gold countryside blurred together at 170 miles per hour. He was headed east, traveling in a private car with Mr. A, Mrs. A, and Mr. Y, all of them on their way to the 1992 Shoshinkai held in Tokyo. Shoshinkai was Japan's annual industry event similar to the Consumer Electronics Show, except that Shoshinkai only featured video games, and even more specifically, it only featured video games made by Nintendo and their licensees. It was an important occasion, headlined by a keynote speech from Nintendo's president, which explained why Mr. Y was making the 3-hour trip east, and why Mr. A had made a 10-hour plane trip to join him for this train ride. Most of the commute had consisted of Mr. A rolling his eyes as Mrs. A translated Mr. Y's bombardment of questions for Harmon. The inquiries were typically directed at Harmon because the young American understood video games better than most employees on either side of the ocean, and also because Mr. Y loved challenging people with questions. And he suspected that his daughter and his son-in-law did not much appreciate jumping through hoops. Why do people enjoy playing video games? He asked. Why should Nintendo make hardware when the real money is made on software? And why is it that only the Japanese know how to make good games? Harmon answered all with savvy and sincerity, until at some point along the way, the other members of his party dozed off. Harmon found a strange joy in witnessing Mr. A and Mr. Y at rest. Both men were such unforgiving workaholics that at times it was truly hard to imagine that either ever slept. Mr. A typically hung around NOA headquarters until after midnight, and Mr. Y was rarely seen anywhere outside the office. Although both men possessed vastly different leadership styles, Mr. A saw himself as one of the guys, Mr. Y saw himself as the guy, each had earned the right to take it easy and enjoy life. But these were no ordinary businessmen. Rather, they were artists, and nothing gave them greater joy than being authors of culture, purveyors of technology, and most important, architects of emotion. In the same way that those responsible for envisioning, financing, and constructing this speedy train had indirectly awed Harmon with a sense of power as the train rushed through the countryside, Mr. A and Mr. Y were responsible for creating similar feelings of possibility for an entire generation. With jobs like those, it was no wonder business was their pleasure. And it was no wonder that they would take a brief nap whenever their bodies and minds were willing to rest. However, when Harmon looked away from the window and found Mr. Y examining him with those crisp, inquisitive, metallic eyes, he began to wonder whether Nintendo's president had ever really fallen asleep. Maybe this was just another test. If it was, then from the looks of Mr. Y's clenched teeth smile, Harmon felt like he had passed. Later that day, from inside the Silver Dome to Makuhari Messe Convention Center in Chiba City, thousands of adoring fans gathered to discover the latest and greatest from Nintendo. It was August 26th, and between the addictive Super Mario Kart and adorable Tiny Toon Adventures and the assortment of indistinguishable Street Fighter II clones, these video game zealots would ecstatically spend the next 72 hours waiting for the chance to try out the newest games. The lines were long and twisty, but the incredulous, oh my God, expressions on their faces told the whole story. It was as if they had died and gone to Mode 7 heaven. Nothing could snap them out of their wonderful stupor. Nothing, that is, until their pious God arrived. Hiroshi Yamauchi, the unparalleled Mr. Y, stepped to the podium. Without prompting or prodding,
Members of the crowd uniformly dropped their controllers to listen to Nintendo's 65-year-old president, wearing, as he always did, a dark tie and a pair of caramel-tinted glasses. Yamauchi unveiled what was planned for the coming year. He began by cautioning the audience that the marvels of Mode 7 had only been the beginning. The best was yet to come. A joyous future indeed, because in early 1993, Nintendo would be launching something called the Super FX chip. Unlike anything ever made before, this custom-made RISC processing device would be used in select cartridges to render true, groundbreaking three-dimensional graphics. The Super FX chip was Nintendo's answer to the Sega CD. Not directly, as neither had been developed with the other in mind, but metaphorically, it highlighted the difference between each company's approach to technology. Sega, with its CD device and its recently rumored plans for a virtual reality peripheral, planned to leap forward through innovative hardware. Nintendo, with its Mode 7 and this Super FX chip, was dedicated to evolving through upgrades in the software. Sega's approach was riskier and more costly, but if successful, it could shift the entire paradigm. If Sega CD caught on or virtual reality became the diversion du jour, then Sega could take the industry from 0 to 60 in half a heartbeat. Nintendo, however, ignored this sprint and chose to run a marathon through gradual innovations. Not only would consumers not have to routinely shell out small fortunes, but by transplanting technology into software, hardware's most vital organ, this would extend the lifespan of the Super Nintendo beyond that of its competitor. This was part of the reason Nintendo never considered Sega to be a serious long-term threat, or at least it provided a valid philosophical justification whenever slumping sales meant thumping denial. The other reason Nintendo didn't consider Sega to be the next coming was epitomized by the event currently taking place at the Makuhari Messe Convention Center. The name of Nintendo's annual trade show was derived from Japan's main association of toy industry retailers, not coincidentally called Shoshinkai. The Shoshinkai was a multi-tier distribution network that, also not coincidentally, Yamauchi had come to control over the years. Although the organization had initially been formed to promote friendly relations between industry participants, Nintendo's great products and its pinpoint attention to quality had provided the Shoshinkai something even more enticing. Stability. Nobody got rich, but everyone made money. And the Nintendo-controlled status quo became more important than promoting friendly relations for companies like Atari, NEC, and of course, Sega. Some might say that this was a monopoly, and if such a claim were lobbed at Yamauchi, he very likely might have said, "Thank you," and taken a bow. Unlike America, where monopolies and oligopolies are considered to be capitalism-crippling viruses, in Japan, market control was par for the course. Look no further than the Japanese insurance industry, where not only have the top five firms, Toki, Taisho, Sumitomo, Nippon, and Yasuda, remained in the top five slots for the past 40 years, but over that time, the market shares of each have not increased or diminished beyond a few decimal points. That kind of stability is not so different from the kind of stability that appealed to the Shoshinkai, and further proved that in Japan, the notion of a monopoly was more like that in the board game Monopoly, where the goal was to build hotels on Park Place and wipe out the little guy who thought Baltic Avenue was a worthwhile investment. Time after time, this type of behavior was rewarded, with the only caveat being that if you're going to be the guy with the hotels on Park Place, then you must share some of that fortune with the thimble, the car, and the other pieces in the game. Nintendo did this by keeping the Shoshinkai content, sharing pieces of the pie with licensees like Capcom, Konami, and Namco, and by outsourcing the manufacturing to Japan's other electronic companies like Sony, Sharp, and Ricoh. This closely monitored system of carrots and sticks worked well for Nintendo and its network of partners, but, unsurprisingly, didn't sit well with its competitors. This dynamic was the reason, at least according to Sega of Japan, why they had failed to match Sega of America's success with Sonic, 16-bit systems, and a share of the cultural mindset. From SOJ's perspective, they'd been left out in the rain, faces pressed against the window of Nintendo's Park Place Hotel, with no remaining choice but to beg for scraps from those leaving the royal feast. Sega of Japan's complaints were not unfounded,
But neither were its woes all that different from Sega of America's early struggles. Perhaps there was no Shoshinkai in the United States, but there were retailers like Walmart who didn't want to upset Nintendo or upend the wonderful new status quo. And while companies like Capcom, Konami, and Namco were not willing to work with Sega of Japan, it's not as though they were willing to work with Sega of America. In 1990, the third-party situation at SOA had not been any easier than it was for SOJ. If anything, it had probably been even worse in America, where there were fewer experienced programmers, no domestic manufacturing resources, and a software company bent on reverse engineering the Genesis. So, what was the difference between SOA and SOJ? Was Sega of Japan just a victim of bad luck, bad timing, and their own poorly crafted advertisements? Or was it that when Sega of America found themselves standing drenched outside the Park Place Hotel, Tom Kalinske, Al Nilsson, Shinobu Toyota, and the rest of those risk-takers charged at the windows together and broke through the glass? Whatever the case, the fact remained that Nintendo dominated over 80% of the Japanese video game market. And from the podium at Shoshinkai, Hiroshi Yamauchi hoped to increase his monopoly. After introducing the Super FX chip, he continued to speak about new games, innovations, and characters. What he went on to say was probably very interesting, at least judging by the collective oohs and ahs of the crowd. But Tony Harmon had no idea what Nintendo's deity was talking about. Harmon sat with Nintendo's designers in the back of the auditorium, and couldn't help but wonder if there was anything more boring than listening to someone deliver a passionate speech in a language you did not understand. Watching paint dry was not exactly exciting either, but at least that didn't make you feel oblivious. The only upside to Harmon's boredom was that he got to be bored next to six of Nintendo's living legends. These were the guys responsible for the games, systems, and iconic characters that made Nintendo extraordinary. If Mr. A and Mr. Y were the architects of Nintendo, then these six were the designers, builders, and interior decorators. 1. Gunpei Yokoi, Nintendo's godfather of gaming, the inventor of Game & Watch, Game Boy, all of the early arcade games, and essentially, the company's entry into video games. Yokoi was the head of R&D 1, a division that created both hardware and software, as well as most of Nintendo's peripherals. Currently, they were heavily focused on making games for Game Boy. 2. Takahiro Izushi, a key member of R&D 1 where he had served as Yokoi's right-hand man since 1975, Izushi spearheaded one of Nintendo's first commercial light guns, the Beam Gun Custom, and played an integral role in developing hardware for the Color TV Game 6, Game & Watch, and Famicom. 3. Yoshio Sakamoto, a designer on R&D 1's exclusive team Shikamaru. This subgroup was responsible for designing characters and generating scripts for hit games like Metroid, Kid Icarus, and Wrecking Crew. 4. Masayuki Yumura, the designer of both the Famicom and the Super Famicom, and the leader of R&D 2, which focused almost exclusively on engineering and manufacturing oversight. Also, his wife was the one who had come up with the name Famicom. 5. Genyo Takeda, the head of R&D 3, which was best known for technical software innovations like bank switching, MMC chips, and creating a battery backup that allowed players to save their games, designed specifically for The Legend of Zelda. Although they were the smallest group, they created a handful of notable games like Mike Tyson's Punch-Out and Star Tropics. 6. Shigeru Miyamoto, Nintendo's greatest treasure. Miyamoto had been appointed the leader of R&D 4, which was solely responsible for developing NES Famicom games. In 1992, with the release of the Super Nintendo, this group was renamed the Entertainment Analysis Division, EAD, and was dedicated to developing 16-bit games. In addition to titles like F-Zero and Pilot Wings, EAD was responsible for making all of the Mario and Zelda games. Currently, they were hard at work on a flying game that would launch the new Super FX chip. Whenever Harmon accompanied Mr. A to Japan, he savored the time he got to spend with these men. Their minds just worked at a different level, and it was an inspiring thing to behold. Particularly Miyamoto, who so obviously saw the world differently and used his games to invite others into his memories.
The castles that he used to explore as a boy became the enigmatic dungeons in The Legend of Zelda. The neighbor's vicious dog, held back only by a rusty chain, became the chain chomp villains in Super Mario Bros. 3. And in a million other ways, he managed to transform the invisible world that only he could see into the pixels of these games. In the middle of Mr. Y's speech, Harmon was watching Miyamoto and these other magicians, trying to see the world through their eyes, when suddenly, they all simultaneously shot their heads up at once. In hushed tones and anxious murmurs, they ricocheted whispers back and forth, debating, dissecting, and discussing a matter of contention until their conversation ceased and slowly they all looked up silently at Harmon. "What?" he asked sheepishly, having no idea what had spurred their concerns. Miyamoto was the one who explained. Apparently, Mr. Y had just announced to the world that not only had he bought the Seattle Mariners, but Nintendo was currently making the world's greatest baseball game. A game so perfectly wonderful that it would put all the others to shame. The problem, however, was that he had never previously told any of the R&D heads that he wished to create such a game. "Well," Harmon said, taking this in, "one of us should tell him." Harmon's suggestion spurred another round of murmurs, and after this brief powwow, the designers decided that nobody wanted to tell Nintendo's president that there was no baseball game under development. Instead, they decided that one of them was going to have to produce the game, and to do it so quickly that Mr. Y would never suspect a thing. "Okay," Harmon said, skeptical of this plan. "Who's going to oversee this?"
"You,"
Miyamoto said, and the others chimed in with laughter. "All right," Harmon said, digesting this news. Those were some mighty big eggshells he'd have to walk on, but this was the opportunity Harmon had been waiting for. Mr. Y was so powerful that Nintendo's top magicians would rather make a multi-million dollar game than have a quiet conversation to correct his mistake. Harmon was going to make a baseball game for the Super Nintendo, but for the next few moments, he couldn't help but join in on their laughter. Chapter 36 Prometheus Revisited. Luke Perry, Beverly Hills 90210 Sultan of Sideburns, walked up to the podium at the 8th Annual MTV Video Music Awards, airing live on September 9, 1992. Although each of the awards given out so far that night had been presented by celebrities in pairs, like Halle Berry and Jean-Claude Van Damme, or Marky Mark and Vanessa Williams, Perry, curiously, was alone. But the sly grin on his face revealed that he wouldn't remain alone for very long. After quieting an assault of sexy shrieks, Perry got down to business. "Okay," he started, speaking with the MTV generation's requisite mixture of exhilaration and detachment. "I would like to introduce my co-presenter, because nobody else had the balls to show up and do it." About 20 rows from the stage, Kalinske looked on as the sexy shrieks returned at full blast. He had come down to L.A. to watch the awards with Nilsson, Toyota, Van Buskirk, and the rest of Sega of America's inner circle, minus Diane Adair, who was getting married in 3 days. "So from a land far away and long, long ago," Perry continued, "it's a bird, it's a plane, it's a really bad smell." As the crowd swooned with anticipation, the Sega gang was all smiles. But their upbeat spirits had nothing to do with the incoming mystery guest, and everything to do with the fact that tonight officially marked the beginning of Sega's elaborate plans to finally slay Nintendo. "Ladies and gentlemen," Perry concluded, "it's Fartman!" Amidst sounds of flatulence splatting from the speakers, Radio Shock Jock Howard Stern descended to the stage as his alter ego, Fartman. Dressed in a red cape, golden leotard, and protruding plastic ass, Stern showed off his alleged superpowers, causing a smoky explosion that nearly wiped out Perry. The crowd absolutely loved this. If Perry's cool appearance and casual cadence epitomized the look and feel of the MTV generation, then Stern's superheroics captured its sound and smell. It wasn't just about being gross. Fart jokes had always been funny or unfunny ever since cavemen first discovered green beans. Rather, This was about subverting the system. It was about being outrageous at the most unlikely time, and because there was a level of self-awareness to the act, seemingly unsophisticated actions were upgraded to highly sophisticated comments on society. It was the new coda to the American dream. Not only can you grow up to be anything you want, but you can do whatever you want as well, as long as you can look cool or clever doing it. As Kalinske watched Perry and Stern announce the candidates for Best Metal Hard Rock Video, he didn't waste any neurons on whether this cultural shift signified the downfall of humanity. That was the obvious thing that someone his age was supposed to think, the same thing his father had thought once upon a time. When you turn 40, louder music and shorter attention spans are supposed to indicate the coming apocalypse. But Kalinske had young employees, younger kids, and a forever young marketing mind that was more interested in accepting and understanding than in criticizing and demanding. The world wasn't going to hell. It was just headed to the next level of cool. And Kalinske wanted Sega to be the ones welcoming everyone to that ethereal place. "What do you think?" Nilsson asked, leaning over to Kalinske as Metallica rushed onto the stage to accept their award from Perry and Stern. "Not exactly my cup of tea," Kalinske said. "But I get it, and I feel as though we have pretty good seats for whatever happens next." Tom Kalinske was often right, but his comment at the show was terribly wrong. He and Nilsson had good seats when it came to enjoying host Dana Carvey's finely tuned shenanigans, but there was one thing that being there prevented them from seeing: the official premiere of Sega's commercials for the Welcome to the Next Level campaign, which aired during the MTV Awards. Jeff Goodby, however, got to see them all. After work, he, Silverstein, Sogard, and a few other guys from the agency went down to a dive bar on Union Street called the Bus Stop, where they got to experience the inaugural batch of ads with an unsuspecting focus group of drunken peers. For a crowd that loved music and loved even more what MTV had encouraged music to become, the bar blasted the Video Music Awards on a dozen televisions as if it were the Super Bowl. "It's rather amazing, isn't it?" Goodby mused as the televisions depicted Howard Stern's persona flying up, up and away from the stage. "We spend our entire lives trying to find poetry or comedy in every place imaginable, but no matter what we accomplish, the truth is that nothing can beat a good fart joke."
"Shame on us," Silverstein commented, trying to reinvent the wheel.
"All these years," Sogard added, "and it's been staring us right in the nose." The riff session came to an abrupt end when a new Sega commercial popped up on the television sets.
"Hey, man,"
Goodby shouted to the bartender.
"Turn it up."
An hour ago, the bartender might have laughed off such a request, but now he immediately complied. Although the patrons had started out arguing passionately about whether Van Halen's Right Now or Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit deserved to win Video of the Year, with some side consideration of the supposed backstage feud between Axl Rose and Kurt Cobain, at some point, the conversation had shifted to the Sega ads. Whether it was an ad for Tasmania, a teaser for Sonic 2, or a preview of the upcoming Sega CD, the spots were just electric. They didn't feel like commercials at all, but rather another part of the performance. Some of the commercials were only a heretical 15 seconds long, but because there were so many quick cuts and because they spoke this audience's language so well, 15 seconds was more than enough time. When the commercial ended and the bartender lowered the TV to its regular volume, the guys from Goodby goofily high-fived each other. They were a little tipsy, and their collective coordination could use some work. But you know what? Fuck that. They had pulled it off, and they deserved a high-five however badly they pleased. It had been less than 6 weeks since the Crown Plaza pitch. And since then, they had won the account, shot a shitload of footage, and gotten 5 commercials ready to air. They now had proof that even without Andy Berlin, everything was going to be all right. And this revelation, in some random dive bar on a fateful Tuesday evening, meant the world to the guys from what would soon be called Goodby, Silverstein, and Partners. Through thick and thin, they hadn't lost their mojo. And that was a big deal, because Kalinske wanted 30 more commercials by Christmas.
"Before we acknowledge how much work we have ahead of us," Goodby said, "who's ready to start placing bets on how long it takes Nintendo to respond?"
Quicker cuts? Silverstein guessed. More close-ups? Mario in a leather jacket? The level after the next level? Sogard threw out.
Hey, as long as they don't resort to flatulence, could be said. Although, I do think we ought to address their newest spots, the ones with that Mode 7 thing, or whatever they're calling it.
Ever since the release of Super Mario Kart in late August, Nintendo's ads, promotions, and PR had been touting this Mode 7. Obviously, no sane person fully understood what the hell it actually did, but the implication of Nintendo's technological superiority was obvious to anyone.
Sega needs to own that mindshare. When it comes to tech, we ought to be as synonymous with the future as the Jetsons is.
So maybe we get his boy Elroy to be a spokesman? Silverstein joked. Or, dare I say, Sogard ventured, Jane, his wife? Goodby cackled.
Cut to some neon-lit crack den of the future where Judy Jetson is now suddenly feeling left out.
But back to reality, Silverstein said, or at least our version of it. Does Sega have anything like Mode 7? Ideally a Mode 8? I have to believe that the CD is miles ahead of this, Sogard theorized. For over a year now, both Sega and Nintendo had been making numerous announcements about their plans to soon release a CD-based video game system. But as of September 1992, only Sega had actually unveiled concrete plans to move forward. In October, Sega would be co-hosting a launch party in New York with the new ally, Sony Electronic Publishing. And then a month later, in mid-November, the Sega CD would hit stores just in time for the holiday season. Until that unveiling in New York, nobody knew exactly what to expect from the Sega CD. But Harold Sogard figured that whatever it could do, it would inevitably put this Mode 7 to shame.
I'm inclined to believe the same, Goodby said. But even so, the CD is a different kind of beast. More than just a console, I mean, and we still need a way to show everyone that our car is faster than theirs. Let's touch base with Sega's marketing and see what's there. If the Genesis has some gizmo that we haven't yet heard about, then we're golden. If not, then we'll just make something up.
The guys laughed, sipped their beers, and then returned their eyes to the 1992 MTV Video Music Awards, anxiously awaiting the next commercial break. The scattershot commercials were unlike anything else on television, but that didn't necessarily make them effective. Since the MTV Awards, Kalinske had been receiving lots of congratulatory phone calls, which was promising, but it's not as though people were going to call and tell him how much the ad sucked. He was dying to get his hands on some new sales figures, sell-through numbers, or any other kind of unbiased consumer data, but that type of information was still a few weeks away. Until then, he'd have to keep relying on his gut instincts, Sega's incredible marketing team, and, to his surprise, a bunch of random 8-year-olds. As taking Sega to the next level continued to take Kalinske further away from his family, he tried to make up for any lost moments by doing the little things whenever he had the time. Caring for the baby, bringing home dinner, making it to his daughter's soccer matches. It wasn't much, not compared to the work Karen put into raising 4 kids, but it was critical to his well-being that he find small ways to show them he cared. It was in this spirit that one afternoon in early October, right before an upcoming business trip to New York, he broke away from the office to pick up his daughters from school. He waited for them just outside the school building, where a sea of little faces swam past him on their way to meet their friends, greet their mothers, or hop on a bus. He was busily scanning the flood of students for Ashley and Nicole, until he was distracted by something strange yet familiar.
Sega!
He looked around and found the voice. Some kid wearing a Dream Team t-shirt yelped the word again, this time louder.
Sega!
His friends responded to his outburst with their own versions.
Sega! Sega! Sega!
Kalinske couldn't believe his ears. It was one of those rare moments in life where there is no choice but to actually do a double take. The kids were imitating Jimbo Matheson's Sega scream, and they were doing a pretty darn good job. This was way better than new sales figures and sell-through numbers. This was pop culture popping before his eyes, kernels thrown into the cultural microwave and coming out as fluffy popcorn. Even more remarkable
was that these kids couldn't be more than 10 years old, which was younger than Sega's intended audience. That was Mario's territory. And while Sega was more than happy to convert anyone ready to graduate to Sonic, this demographic was more of a long-term hope than a short-term goal. But evidently, Sega's message had reached the teenagers loud and clear, and now it was trickling down to their younger Nintendo-age siblings who wanted to be cool like their older brothers. If the ads were originally supposed to act as a dog whistle that signaled directly to the mutts of the world, teens, rebels, hardcore gamers, apparently, there also is a large population of puppies out there whose ears could pick up this frequency, or, at the very least, puppies who didn't fully understand the noise, but cared enough to fake it. As Kalinske's daughters came into focus, a smile naturally came across his lips. He couldn't wait to smother each with a giant hug. But before setting aside the big ideas of corporate dad for the smaller moments in life, he allowed himself one last look at the herd of Sega screamers. It was a beautiful thing to unexpectedly hear his company's name shouted by kids no more than 4 feet tall. But that was nothing compared to the thrill of watching others do the same at a whopping 40 feet tall. This was an unusual comparison to make, but one that Kalinske couldn't avoid while staring at Sony's gigantic Jumbotron in the heart of Times Square as it broadcasted Sega's promos at larger-than-life size. "I'm speechless," Nilsson admitted, standing beside his boss in a similar stupor. They were looking out the window of the Marriott Marquis' Broadway lounge, momentarily oblivious to the hundreds of bodies busily moving around them.
"Me too," Kalinske said with a single nod of agreement.
And then, for a few long seconds, they continued to stare ahead, enjoying parallel moments of whatever it was they couldn't quite verbalize. Kalinske and Nilsson had come to New York with a handful of colleagues to officially unveil the Sega CD at an event jointly hosted with Olaf Olafsson and the guys from Sony Electronic Publishing. It was October 15th, 1992, and although the system and its games, 6 from Sega, 5 from Sony, wouldn't go on sale until next month, this was the public's first chance to see what Kalinske was hailing as the formal wedding between Hollywood and Silicon Valley. To back up this bold claim, he wished to create a spectacle worthy of the product itself, and called in a favor with Sony's Olaf Olafsson to borrow their Jumbotron for the day in order to showcase Sega's breakthrough CD-ROM technology. Or, to put it more poetically, as per the one-liner that Van Buskirk had given Kalinske to feed the journalists in attendance, "It takes a video screen the size of more than 500 home televisions to indicate how big an idea we think Sega CD and interactive cinema will be to video game players." Using the Jumbotron to boast giant-sized game footage was a clever touch, but ultimately it wasn't all that different from how movie studios promoted big films, or how fast food companies boasted about their latest burger creations. That was fine, but it wasn't groundbreaking enough for Sega. So instead of simply broadcasting footage, they rigged the Jumbotron so that it would become the gigantic screen for a Sega CD system set up in the Broadway lounge. This way, guests at the launch party would leave with a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and those watching the big screen from below in Times Square would vicariously enjoy the experience of the Sega CD's video games. This was Sega-worthy. This was Sonic-worthy. This was the next level. For Kalinske and his employees at Sega of America, the next level was not just a marketing catchphrase, but a full-fledged philosophy of how to tackle life. Personally and professionally, it was a challenge to work the hardest, think the fastest, and always find the fun in whatever needed to get done. It was a perpetual dare to dream like Walt Disney, who is dedicated to plussing everything that he and his Imagineers ever touched, innovate like Steve Jobs, who was always searching for new ways to put a dent in the universe, and take risks like the mythological trickster Prometheus, who stole fire from the gods and gave it to humanity. Although if Prometheus had been a Sega employee, Kalinske would have expected not just fire, but also a stylish fireworks ceremony too. That was the next level, or at least an approximation of the attitude. But the phrase and the values behind it were about more than just flowery words. In fact, those words would have been all but moot
if not for the actions they inspired. Coming off the heels of Boca, Sega's defensive mentality at CES had made sense, but Nintendo's very aggressive price drop signified that they were waking up. So to try to put his competitor back to sleep, Kalinske recommitted himself to stay